Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I am here with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing good. We are joined with a special guest, semi-professional poker player, longtime poker player, Jason Brawl. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on here. We are going to be talking about a very specific event in poker history today. I told you guys this story, but I think it's worth sharing. I mentioned it to a friend. I said we were going to be talking about Black Friday, and my friend really did genuinely think I was talking about Thanksgiving and Thanksgiving sales. So I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with Black Friday in poker and what it was, what it means, what has happened since then, and why it's kind of been, like, poker is popular again, I'd say.
Around the world, for sure. Yeah, I would say online poker and live poker are two different things, but specifically, like, Black Friday affected online poker, but there's still, Poker Stars is still out there, and there's a site called GG Poker, which is probably the most popular nowadays. It's decent, yeah, again, just people that run poker platforms, basically.
Before we get into current affairs, can you describe what Black Friday was? What happened?
So I was playing poker on Black Friday, actually the day. I remember it pretty well. Basically, I don't remember which branch of the government, but basically they took over Full Tilt and PokerStars domain at one time.
In absolute,
and basically said, "Hey, don't service American customers anymore, and we'll give you back your domain." I think that's basically the gist of how that day went for them. But I was still using Full Tilt that day. I made a deposit on Full Tilt just to mess around because I thought it would be fun to see if the money would actually come from my bank account. And it did, which kind of surprised me. But I think I had a couple thousand dollars on my Full Tilt account at that point, and I didn't really have that much on my PokerStars account anymore. So I didn't get affected, but I had friends or new people that lost, or not lost, but had six figures just in limbo just that day because they weren't expecting, obviously.
But everyone got it back?
As long as you filed a claim. So there were some people that had issues filing a claim for whatever reasons, right? But a majority of the people that I knew that like went through the process and didn't forget about filing the claim, like, got their money back.
Bennett, I'm sure you know about the exact court case that this is all about, right?
I know a little bit about the court case, and there's actually a specific angle on the court case that I wanted to bring up, because the reason the government ended up being able to bring this court case, which was a combination of bank fraud and money laundering charges aimed at the executives of these firms, and then a civil complaint about some of the way they were handling their business, was because their Australian payments processor, when Daniel Tzekov flipped and became state's witness. And so he was able to provide the government with a lot of the information they ended up using for the final indictments. And the interesting part, for me at least, is that when he was initially indicted and his operation was shut down, Full Tilt and PokerStars claimed that he had cheated them out of about $100 million they had given to him. And so the reason I just thought that specific feature of the case was notable and interesting was because it reminded me in some respects of the crypto capital case.
Yeah, isn't it like officially U.S. government versus Scheisenberg, whatever.
That's right.
The CEO of PokerStars, who, it's funny, I think last 2 or 3 years he like officially cleaned himself of everything or whatever, because I think they made another settlement recently or something like that.
Okay.
So he doesn't have any of the problems that he was dealing with after that court case or whatever it was.
It caused a lot of problems. I also think I assume that Calvin Ayer's empire was affected by this, or am I wrong?
So like Bovada or Bodog?
Yeah.
Like, so I kept using those sites, and I know a lot of other people did, but yeah, I know their poker platform or their poker client wasn't as big from that point or whatever they were offering. I think they still do offer something with poker, but it's definitely not as big as it was before.
And Bodog wasn't included in this specific indictment. They were indicted separately on a different date than these three platforms, which was Ultimate Bet, PokerStars, and Full Tilt.
Here's, I think, the important aspect of Black Friday is I think the effects are still being felt to this day, because at that point, this I asked essentially a stupid question. There is such thing as a stupid question, but I asked why the World Series of Poker main event, the largest pot ever, was in 2008, 2009. Yeah,
first place. You're talking about the most money that a first place winner has ever won in a poker tournament.
And it was, at this point, like 12, 13 years ago. And everyone was like, well, obviously, because that was when the most people were in the game.
Yeah, playing online poker.
Yeah.
So basically, like, Full Tilt and PokerStars would have satellites online where you would pay anywhere under $1,000 or $10,000, and then you would get a seat to the main event. And then obviously after all this stuff happened, that just kind of disappeared.
Right. And so this caused a dramatic effect for anyone who was a professional poker player, I would assume, at that point.
I mean, I had friends that the decision they made, or I know a lot of people, they basically moved out of the United States after 2011 because their main source of income was playing online poker. So they moved to places like Mexico and Thailand just to live in a place that's not in the United States, just so they could keep playing on PokerStars, basically. Because there weren't, and there really aren't, as many options for U.S.-based people to play online poker at this point. So if your living was playing online poker, you kind of were forced into choosing between staying in the United States or moving somewhere else and continuing to play online poker.
Do you think that's shifting now? Do you think that's changing? Do you think that the rules are lightening up?
I mean, rules are rules, right? So I know people that have gotten in trouble playing in countries that they say they weren't in, or misrepresenting where they were by using VPNs, and they'll get caught. I guess it's a question of who's enforcing the rules and how much risk tolerance do you have playing on a platform you shouldn't be playing on.
But there are places you can play online poker now.
Legally in the States, yeah. Pennsylvania, Delaware.
New Jersey,
yeah. Nevada, there's a few states.
The reason I was asking about a shift in policy, which at least on a state level, it sounds like now there is a sort of a shift in policy.
Yeah, you can play legal poker now.
Right? But it's taken a really long time for that to happen. And that all is essentially because of the events of Black Friday.
Yes.
And what was the reason for Black Friday? Like, why did this happen? What rules were being broken? Why were these people getting in trouble for servicing U.S. customers?
Well, I mean, what they were doing is illegal, right? And I mean, like, they were misrepresenting the payment processing for sure. I've definitely had times where I deposited on an online poker site, I won't say which one, but where it was like me buying a diamond necklace. And I definitely wasn't buying a diamond necklace to deposit $1,000 on their website. So I think it was pretty easy for the government to say, hey, you guys are misrepresenting what these deposits was for. And if you look at it, Party Poker left the U.S. market. Like, they made that decision, I think it was in 2006 or 2007. So it was a decision that PokerStars and Full Tilt knew that they were making that was probably going to cost them at some point.
Did any of these people do jail time?
Yeah, several of the executives ended up going to jail. Absolute Poker co-founder Brent Buckley spent between a year and a half in prison. There was Ira Rubin, who spent 3 years in prison, and John Campos, who was associated with the bank that they invested in and who was mislabeling transactions so that they could continue to process bank payments. He got sentenced to 3 months.
And I mean, Absolute Poker was its own shenanigans in and of itself, outside of whatever Full Tilt and PokerStars were doing, right? Because they had the secret users and all that fun stuff. So, I mean, that could have been part of why the government did what they did, because if they knew or they had some inkling of what the people at Absolute were doing, then maybe you would assume that that's happening at Full Tilt and PokerStars too. And then it's like, why let this keep going on?
And can you describe that? Because I think a lot of people aren't familiar with the you're talking about cheating and
yeah. Well, it's super cheat. It's the word. It's
God mode.
God mode, right? It would, yes. And I think I can say it as a fact at this point, right? Yeah, I don't think it's like
there was a back door.
Yeah. Well, I think there's still a question of who exactly had access to it, and there have been people that have speculated and denied it at this point. So, I mean, whatever. You can name a huge poker star, and there's a chance that whatever, they might have been using it. But the idea is, for playing a hand of poker tournament, the people that had God mode were able to look at the exact cards that everyone playing against them had. So it was the easiest way to make money if you knew what you were doing.
So as you said, everyone who is anyone kind of like was involved in all of this.
Well, if you look at Full Tilt, like the biggest names, I mean, if you know poker names, had some involvement back then. Guys like Chris Ferguson, Phil Ivey, Howard Letter, Annie Duke. The question for everyone was who knew what at what point, right? Because each one of the companies had its own issues. Full Tilt supposedly was paying a draw to each one of the founders or investors of about like $1 million a month or something like that, supposedly. And that's really what the issue with Full Tilt was, because the accounting was just supposedly off completely. I had a friend who, this is 2010, he had a Full Tilt account, and Full Tilt wasn't taking money out of his bank account when he was making deposits onto the site. So I know of some people that also had these like phantom accounts or whatever you want to call them. So from my anecdotal like life, at least, I could say for sure Full Tilt, it was just complete whateverness in terms of money coming in, money coming out. And it makes sense that they would have issues with their payment processor for sure.
Yes. Some related color I want to add is that when Ultimate Bet was doing their God mode stuff, that overlaps with the period our friend Stuart Hoegner was the director of compliance for their parent company, Excapsa. And then, Full Tilt was actually described by the federal government in their complaint as a Ponzi scheme, where the board members and owners had been paid more than $440 million while it had been insolvent.
Yeah, and the thing with Ultimate Bet was, and if anyone wants to look this up, that's the best, that's the fun part of online poker. There's a forum called 2P2. 2+2, and a lot of this went down in real time on these forums because people, they figured out that someone was had God mode at a certain point. So then it just became a question of like, and it's a very difficult thing to prove, right? It's within poker, like you can accuse someone of something, but the proof is sometimes hard unless you have a lot of evidence, right? There's a guy named Mike Postle. Yeah, there's a guy named Mike Postle who's legit like cheating on a live stream in Sacramento, and it took a while for people to even accept that he was cheating.
He won something like 32 out of 37
statistical 32. Improbability, basically. Yeah,
to the point of impossibility.
He had God mode.
Yeah, I want to bring up that obviously poker is not innovative. Poker has been around for like hundreds of years now.
Yeah,
but it attracts a certain brand of person generally, right? And I think what you'll see, I mean, let's keep it real, what we just were talking about, all these high brand professionals were
skimming off the top,
repping the worst kind of companies. And I think you got to be a certain kind of person to do that. You got to be a certain brand of person. And what I've noticed over the past several years, and I'm sure this happened a lot earlier because I think you've been involved in crypto much longer than I have, but they seem to both attract similar types, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just think about it, it's logical, right? Government coming down and stopping payment processing through whatever bank system, SWIFT, whatever you want to call it. Like, you can't use your Visa card anymore to deposit on a online poker site. Then what's the next option, right? You have to kind of figure out. A lot of the things became like Western Union buying prepaid cards and using those to deposit. I think it was like 2014, 15 was like one of the first times I saw a poker site accepting crypto as a deposit option. I mean, I know there were some like really, really basic gambling sites you could deposit crypto on, or like fake, like whatever you want to call whatever that was back then. And then Bovada, for a really long time, you could figure out a way to deposit crypto, but it wasn't the easiest thing.
Do you think that Black Friday helped push the acceptance of crypto in general?
Well, okay, I'll put it like this, right? If you're in Australia, right, and I'm in the States and you need to get me a bunch of money, like, what's the easiest way to do that? Sometimes back then, at least, avoiding the eyes of
AML KYC.
Yeah, right. Well, no, but it's between two people, right? Like, is there AML KYC when it's me and you and we're doing like a transfer.
It depends on how much cash, right?
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I'll say this, like I had people offering to send me coin 2015, 2016, and I'm sure it was 2014 as well. So if you went to someone and said, hey, like you just went through this experience with the American government, now you live in a foreign country, transacting in dollars doesn't make a ton of sense for you. Here's this thing, right? I don't know what this thing is. I don't know. In terms of allowing for transactions and avoiding the U.S. government knowing you just made that transaction, it's a pretty decent mechanism. At least back then, for sure it was. Also, people want to avoid taxes, and that was the easiest way to avoid taxes if you were dealing with poker stuff back then as well.
Well, and I mean, I think it's pretty clear, just based on the number of former poker players there are in crypto, that Black Friday probably ended up pushing a certain number of people who are now prominent crypto people into crypto, right?
Oh, for sure.
You got the catalyzing event. It dovetails with the ideology. And if you're a person who enjoys a little bit high risk, speculative gambling type activities, the crypto markets are going to scratch that itch for you.
Well, I've always seen the argument that it's not similar in the way to poker, but it's asymmetric information, right? And it's utilizing leverage. And that's the number one thing in crypto, or how a lot of people have made their money in crypto. It's knowing when to whatever push information that you might have, and
know when to hold them and know when to fold them.
And know when to push your odds, right? Because if you're taking 10x leverage, like, you got to be smart when you do that, whenever you do that, or whenever you did do that. So I definitely think the skill sets align. And again, if you're trying to hide your money from the government, there's really no other easier way back than I could think of, especially if, again, you're moving money between different sites and different platforms and you're trying to avoid fees.
Was Liberty Reserve a tool that a lot of these poker sites were using, or not at all?
I wouldn't know from that point, but I wouldn't be surprised. But I think Liberty Reserve was a little bit afterwards, if I'm not wrong.
Wasn't Liberty Reserve indicted in 2011 as well? So,
I mean, that's what I'm wondering if it's related.
I never used Liberty. I don't remember it being a crossover, because again, it was pretty easy to deposit on PokerStars and Full Tilt back then. You just needed a Visa card. Like, it didn't get declined if you had the funds.
I think the way they kept it easy to deposit for a lot of that is really fascinating, because they invested in this like small bank in Utah and started paying them basically to miscode their transactions so they could continue to accept these deposits and process these payments to keep it open.
Like, I mean, again, it's a question of like, am I as the payee in trouble ever? And I don't really think so in any of this. But like, I was doing that for Bovada, like 2015 still, 2014 for sure. Like, again, like I said, I was buying like necklaces and pens or whatever. Or that's what they coded them as.
It's funny to me because you see so much of this in crypto. Like,
oh, for sure.
When Bennett and I started looking into all of this stuff in 2017, 2018, like, you could still make deposits on these cryptocurrency exchange platforms from a U.S. bank, and they would do it through whatever crazy small third-party payment processor from the Philippines, or from, you know what I mean, Singapore or something, where they're definitely pop-up, fly-by-night, kind of like, let's see what happens with this and how quickly it gets shut down.
Some guy got a license and, he's renting it out or whatever,
I think that's probably going to be true for just about any gray bordering on black market items, right? We saw the same thing with Backpage when they started having issues with getting payments through the main processors for the credit card networks. They were doing a similar thing where you'd buy quote-unquote expensive items, and that's what would actually like get you the credit to make your transactions. And so I think those techniques are going to be pretty universal across those type of sectors.
Can I go back to the Stewart thing? I know you talked about it, Bennett, but isn't that like the funniest part about all this? The guy that was defending, I don't even want to be talking about it, but I know that's what you guys love. The guy that was defending super users vehemently, in whatever capacity that he was, is now doing whatever he's doing now.
It's something that someone has to do it, right? Like, these people need...
Doesn't Lex Luthor need an attorney? I guess that's
if he got sued by the U.S. government, yes. Like, someone needs to be willing to represent these people, whether I like it or not. And I think what's unfortunate, it's not funny to me, it's just unfortunate that he's getting paid probably big bucks to...
Well, he has to have some investment, right? He has to have equity, I would say.
I don't know. I'm not making that claim.
Okay, I said it. It's come after me.
I would expect that Stuart Hoefner has equity in Tether and Bitfinex.
I would hope for his. I mean, that's my. That would be me.
I mean, at one point he held the entire Tether reserve in his bank account.
Like, what I won't refute is that he is thoroughly intertwined with the infrastructure of Bitfinex and Tether. That is for sure.
So, like, when they're hiring him, you don't think they know, like, where he comes from, like, what he did?
And that's why they hired him. Like, it because he had worked with...
Why did OJ hire Cochran? Why do people hire the very best criminal defense attorneys when they are looking real guilty? I don't know.
Well, and after Stu was done at Xcapa, which he only spent like 2006 there when they were having the whole sale of Ultimate Bet with...
They got away with it though, right? Am I wrong? No one went to prison and they still fleeced users, I believe, right? For a lot. Like they gave back some funds, but overall, didn't they fleece?
So by the time of Black Friday, Ultimate Bet was operated by Sirius Networks. Back in 2005 and 6, when they started using the God mode on Absolute Poker and Ultimate Bet, that's when Xcapsa was the parent company and when Stu was there. Yeah, and then Stu was only there for the calendar year of 2006, then went and did his own practice, right, where he started working with, well, a few years after that, he started working with the early Bitcoin casinos, right, and doing that kind of work. And so he was familiar with all the payment processor tricks, all the like cryptocurrency gambling connections. So it's clear why he'd end up with Tether and Bitfinex.
It brings up another point that I think is actually very interesting about that, which is that how thoroughly involved I assume all of these countries are in both poker and cryptocurrency when it comes to Canada. And when it comes to places like, I don't know, let's just for instance say like Antigua or the British Virgin Islands.
Little Black Friday related anecdote about that. Antigua and Barbuda, threatened action against the United States for seizing the domains and shutting off these operations, claiming that it was in breach of like international agreements.
Which, if I'm not mistaken, like they haven't really done that again that often since then, right? Or it's been a very... Like I you definitely know this better than I do, but that seems like one of the last times, and it seems like people have argued that was an overstretch by the U.S. government.
Domain seizures?
In that capacity or in the way that they did it, at least.
Basically, they were claiming they were shutting down the entire business like that for like the U.S.-centered thing, and these businesses are domiciled elsewhere, and the domain name is like part of their assets, and so that the U.S. is using its international power in an inappropriate manner.
And because I think the international body that controls domain names is not technically like a U.S. government organization, there was like a sovereign thing or whatever.
Yeah, ICANN.
Yeah, but .coms specifically go through the U.S., and so that's how they're able to do it. And so like other domains, they can't seize because they're like for specific countries and stuff.
But like it hasn't really happened again since, right? There haven't been that many .coms that have just been like, okay, this is...
How many...
Backpage in 2014 or whenever that was.
Yeah, Backpage was the other one I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it'll happen again.
No, yeah, for sure. But I think it's more difficult now than it was. I guess that's my point within it.
Maybe. I don't know. I think that we've heard about international cooperation between agencies in certain regards to certain investigations. I think crypto would be a good candidate for something like that, where you would see... I know, like, one of my favorites, Paul LaRue, like, you had so many different agencies working together to get that guy. So it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of well-funded government agencies are keen on looking into crypto and what it's used for, who's using it, and then if they feel like it, doing some sort of... It wouldn't be that hard to do some sort of Black Friday event in cryptocurrency. I truly believe that. I don't think it would be that difficult.
I certainly think it's possible, but I think that before they would want to do it, the government would want to be very confident that they have dotted the I's and crossed the T's.
Well, also, I don't know. Again, I'm not a legal expert in any way whatsoever.
Nor are we. I want to state none of us are lawyers.
Yes, not in any. I pretend like I'm a lawyer, but I'm definitely not a lawyer. I would say from a judicial standpoint, the courts are much more conservative than they were, especially in like 2011, 2012. So I think the U.S. government's going to have to do more to have the effect of Black Friday. I think if you look at what the Federal Reserve is doing in terms of like their stability studies or whatever, that to me would bring more grounds to some of the stuff that you're talking about, especially from a intra-government standpoint where it's just more than the U.S. government focusing its efforts on a Black Friday type event.
I just don't think, like, the Treasury, you have, like, IRS Criminal Investigation Unit, you have the SEC, you have all these regulatory agencies that can do things. But what it really took for Black Friday, I mean, that was the FBI, right?
Yeah, the FBI was the one who led it.
And Liberty Reserve was also the FBI?
I mean, the Liberty Reserve was a massive coalition of like 23 different groups internationally. And so those cases can happen, but it's just not a thing to expect or plan around.
Yeah, exactly.
Black Swan, sure. Black Swan event.
I guess that's kind of why it's called Black. It was very surprising that day again, because I went on 2+2 and everyone was like, why can't I play Poker Stars anymore? Why can't I play Full Tilt? And it was like, okay, this is what's happening in real time. So,
which is different than what happened with Liberty Reserve, where they just plastered this domain name has been seized by the U.S. government on the homepage. So those are different examples, I suppose.
Yeah. And so they can do it, but I would never expect that. And it always really comes down to a question of political will and desire to go that way, right? And so if there's not the desire among regulators and politicians to wage these difficult cases, then they don't get done. And I think that was also one of the lessons of the Black Friday in the poker industry, is that it wasn't a super popular case. Like, there wasn't a ton of approval publicly for them to go after these poker sites, and there wasn't like a great moral story that the government was able to put together around it. And so like it ended up probably in terms of like the ability to build that kind of political will being a little bit damaging in that way.
Well, and God bless his dead soul, but the whole like conspiracy theory that every poker player has, or, I mean, it's obviously not a conspiracy theory, is all of this is Sheldon Adelson's fault. He was the one that was pushing for the bans on online poker all the way back from 2006, 2005.
Why?
Because he owns casinos, so forcing online poker is not a distraction option will push more people to go play at the Venetian and go play at whatever. And so he's also a hardcore Republican donator, so that was a part of his social mission of platform things, whatever he believed in.
Certainly not here to defend Sheldon, but I will say that like I do love playing poker with people. It is super enjoyable to me versus online poker, which has like zero personality. But I do understand that if you're trying to make money doing it, yeah, online is like it just makes more sense.
I mean, if you think about it, the last 2 years is the best time for online poker ever, right? People sitting at home can't do anything. They have their laptop. Like, I think GG Poker saw a humongous spike in its volume, just people having nothing to do all day, right? And being able to log in and lose a couple dollars, win a couple dollars, whatever it is.
Crypto did well on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think they all go hand in hand at a certain point, yeah, right? It's illicit. I don't want to say illicit, but like what Bennett said, gray activities all go up together and down together sometimes.
And it's just an interesting thing culturally for me at this point, because you saw this kind of government effort against online poker during this period. And now we seem to have almost like a nationwide embrace of sports gambling. Right, you can't watch a sporting event now without half the ads basically being for what's effectively gambling on sport, and like sports betting, like that was the type of gambling that was actually explicitly illegal already under like the Wire Act in the U.S. government, whereas poker was not. And now you see like this almost like wholesale reversal on that fact.
Well, it's the age-old argument of, is poker a game of skill or luck, right? Because that would be the determining factor of whether or not it is a gambling operation, because, I mean, they've had court cases about this specific issue, and I think the judges have all pretty much ruled that it is a game of luck still. But if we could prove, or if you could prove that poker is a game of skill, then theoretically some of this online issue stuff would go away. And I know people have argued that before. But yeah, no, sports betting and online poker and crypto all go hand in hand. A lot of it, again, is Calvin, right? Because he pushed an online platform that took crypto and paid out in crypto. So I think one more thing that I always find interesting, there's always been the conversation that the reason why poker players love NFTs is because we use them on our poker platforms, right? We had a little profile picture when you would play. So it became a natural thing for poker players, especially a lot of us have Twitter, a lot of them have Twitter, to identify with the PFP as an individual type thing.
That's fine. I mean, that's it very, that, I mean, but that's like a very internet thing. That has, I think that has less to do with poker and more to do with internet communication, where like even being on, I don't know, AOL Instant Messenger, you had a PFP that you like were associated with.
But the thing with poker is people, like, you knew who the person was based on the PFP. Like, that was a thing for some people where it was like, okay, that person is that person because they have that PFP, and people would copy it, whatever, whatever, whatever. So I don't know. I think it's just a funny thing that I've seen people observe on in the space as well.
For me, one of the most interesting things here is like what the government actually chose to pursue these cases on, right? Which was bank fraud and money laundering, based on the fact that the poker companies first misrepresented to banks what exactly their business was in, and then later started actually paying whichever bank they got to cooperate to help them mislabel these transactions and continue to do it. And that was sufficient to get some of these individuals sent to prison and for these sites to be materially changed and the industry around them entirely changed. And I just hope, and this is a thing we went over in our Liberty Reserve episode 2, I do hope that some people have fully thought through the potential implications of that in other industries.
Because they have it in poker. There's still websites that let you play exactly like Full Tilt and PokerStars did. So, and that guy supposedly has a lot of crypto money. So, I mean, I think
that'll close out our Black Friday episode. Sorry, no sales event, no free stuff for anybody listening. But yeah, thank you for joining us, Jason. It was a nice recollection.
I had fun.
If you enjoyed this episode, one of the best things you can do to help support us and help us grow this podcast is to leave a rating, a review, and share it with a friend who you think could enjoy it. I know these things seem small, and it makes me a little bit uncomfortable to ask, but it truly is one of the things that can help us most effectively grow this podcast, and we would truly appreciate you taking a moment to do that. Thank you.